Good morning. Can everybody hear me?
Just the front one.
Come off that. Perfect. Yeah. Everybody can hear. Everybody can see. We're good to go. Thank you, Alice. Thank you particularly for being muy floja in going with the curves that I was throwing you in the last 24 hours, including a massive copying effort, and then rearranging the entire room.
About 5 years ago, I wouldn't have handled that. I'm definitely growing.
There we go. This is going to be just perhaps a little bit different than what you've been used to, in the sense I'm going to throw some pictures at you. My philosophy, really two things at work here. One is, it's a whole lot nicer to look at nice pictures than to look at me. That's my philosophy. See, you see what I look out like, so you don't need to look at me anymore. The second thing, though, is I understand that people learn differently in different ways. Some people learn better by hearing, other people by seeing, and then we're also going to do some group exercises. So my philosophy of popular education is to sort of keep a number of modes going at once. So that's what I'm going to do with you this morning. It's lovely to be with the Word and Life group. Since the last time I was here, I've moved more than two-thirds of the way toward you, moving from Los Angeles up to the Ojai Valley. So it's a much easier drive and nicer drive to get to you. I'm a big fan of what you're doing here. Adults who take the time and space and mindfulness and intention to study scripture and to look at issues and to think about their lives is the hope of the church, in my opinion. It's still an extraordinary thing rather than the ordinary thing that we do, but it is forging the way for a church that is much more about spec acting, seeing and doing, than spectating, which is what too many of our churches are about. So I commend you for the work that you do. And the work that we are doing today and that you are doing in this series and that you do every time you gather is serious work. And I have this first slide up to remind myself and you how serious it is. One of the groups that we work with is Christian Peacemaker Team, which for the last almost 20 years now has been going into conflict areas as a nonviolent presence. CPT has been in Chiapas, it's been in the West Bank of Palestine, it's been in conflict areas in North America, and really since the beginning of the first Gulf War in 1991, it has been in Iraq. About 2.5 months ago, these four men, who were both short and long-term members of the CPT presence in Iraq, were abducted. You need to understand that CPT is the group that broke the Abu Ghraib story. They've been doing incredible human rights work. They are the last remaining unarmed international group in Iraq. And 2.5 months ago, these men were kidnapped by a group called the Swords of Righteousness Brigade, hitherto unknown. And they have been in captivity for 2.5 months. We don't know whether they are alive or dead, although we suspect they are still alive somewhere. It's particularly close to home because Jim Loney in the bottom left-hand corner is a good friend of mine. He's a member of the Catholic worker community in Toronto. It's an ecumenical group. Tom Fox is a Quaker. Norman Kember is a Baptist from the UK. Jim, a Catholic. Hamid, a Catholic. And, you know, this is the real world. And we're going to be talking about nonviolence today, and for too many privileged people, nonviolence is a nice set of ideas and ideals. But for many around the world who are embodying the work of nonviolence, it carries a high cost. And I invite you in the coming months, particularly as we move into Lent, these guys were kidnapped on the first day of Advent. And we have been keeping vigil through Advent, Christmas, Tide, and Epiphany. And now as we enter into Lent, I invite you to think of them in your prayer life and pray for them. The website on the bottom left-hand corner is a site where you can get daily updates on that situation. That's just a little bit of a reality check for us as we talk about nonviolence. It is indeed serious business. The other thing that I want to say at the outset is I loved Michael's chapter because he really tries to get right down to what this stuff means. And what I want to do in the course of the short time we have together is move from a reflection on both the scriptural text and Michael's text to real context that we inhabit and real practices. Because I think if we don't do that, then we haven't really read the text. We haven't really understood the text until we figure out what are some of the things that it actually concretely might mean in our lives. I think that's the drift of his book. I believe that's really the purpose of your gathering to study. So let's get to the theme of the chapter. On page 82 of the chapter of the book, Mike refers to the Act of Thomas as an early Christian apocryphal writing that offers an entire meditation on the notion of meekness as nonviolence. He refers to it, but he doesn't cite it. And so I went to look it up, and I thought, gee, this is really nice. Let's start with it. And perhaps somebody with a nice, strong voice could read it. The only English translation of this early 3rd century text is sort of King James-esque, so I've updated the language a little bit. And I've also, each time the word meekness appears, I've put the word nonviolence, because it was at one of the pieces of Mike's interpretation of the third beatitude. So let me have a nice, loud voice read this little meditation. Yes, go ahead, Mark.
The nonviolence has overcome death and brought him under authority. Nonviolence has enslaved the enemy. Nonviolence is individual. Nonviolence is neither fierce nor opposes in choice. Nonviolence is peace and joy and the exaltation of the minority. Abide therefore in freedom, in the freedom of the meek, and be near to nonviolence. For in these two heads, holiness is the presence, and the one who dwells in her receives her hospitality. Because for 40 days and 40 nights Christ fasted, tasting nothing, and he that keeps her shall dwell in her as a monastery, and nonviolence is his boast. For he said to Peter, our fellow apostle, turn back your sword and put it away, for if I had wanted to, could I not have brought more than 12 legions of angels to my father?
Both Psalm 37, we read it in the opening litany, and this text, we might say bracket our beatitude text. Psalm 37, of course, being hundreds of years before the New Testament, and this text a couple of centuries after the New Testament. But both texts make it very clear that two things are true. One, as our intrepid president likes to put it, we really are in a struggle in history between good and evil. That might be one of the rare points of connection between our president and the scriptural tradition. On the other hand, where our president is dead wrong is that the people of God in that struggle are exhorted both by Psalm 37 and by this text to take a very firm stance of nonviolence. That violence simply does not have the power to undo violence in the world any more than injustice has the power to resolve injustice. Only nonviolent struggle for justice have the power and the character to ultimately overturn the rule of death. And that, again, is a sort of sober reminder that when we approach these issues, we are not approaching peripheral issues. We're approaching core issues of our identity and the meaning of our vocation in history. I'm mindful that I'm coming right after the author himself last week, so it's a pretty tough act to follow. Hope you had a good time with Michael. He's a delightful character. Michael is well known around the traps for a couple of things. One is he's one of the leading scholars on Matthew's Gospel, so he's done well to employ his book. He's written both scholarly stuff and popular stuff. And he's been around for a long time. Michael and I actually were around the Graduate Theological Union at about the same time. And he has been writing and stuff for a quarter of a century. His the book you're reading now, as you know, is a rewrite of the original edition, came out in 1981. And really has had a wide impact. So a lot of folks have used that book. We used to use it back in the 80s. It's just a really nice piece. I love this rewritten edition because knowing the earlier edition, Michael's much stronger in this book on a number of issues. He's much more contextual. He's much more clear about locating himself socially. That's one of the learnings of New Testament scholars in the past 20 years, is that you can't pretend like you're some scholar floating above reality, giving objective opinions. You know, we all are located somewhere. We're reading the scripture from a place in the world, and he's much more forthright about talking about that. He's much more clear about directing his comments at folk like you all in this room. And I think that those are all good things. He's also much stronger in talking about the problem of the male clerarchy in the church, which still not a lot of priests are very forthright about. So I commend him for that. And he's strong on talking about some of the real dark sides, such as the pedophilia scandal. So I really think that this is, in every way, a stronger book because he's updated it, but he's also focused it more on our actual context. So great piece. Michael and I have been working in parallel tracks in the sense that we both believe that our task as North American New Testament interpreters is, in fact, to be developing an indigenous theology of liberation. That is something that is very contextual to our own situation here in the first world. It's great to think about what folk are doing in Latin America or Asia, but this is our context. We've got to figure out what this stuff means for us. So let's spend a few minutes looking at the third beatitude. I certainly agree with his translation of the term meek as nonviolent. I think it's one of those little breakthroughs of translation in which if we update the language, the text comes alive. Wouldn't you agree? Meekness sort of has a bad rap. Nonviolence leads to a whole different world of practice. Suddenly we are in the world of Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Aung San Suu Kyi and the great practitioners of nonviolence. The greatest, perhaps, of which was Jesus himself. I didn't find much to sort of quibble with Michael's exposition. Really, most of his chapter is talking about what this means for us, and so I want to preserve that focus. But just a few points about what he says in terms of the text itself. He makes a note that the term praus in Greek, or meek, appears three times only in Matthew. And I thought it might be interesting to look at the third of those times. Obviously, the third beatitude is the first time we encounter it. Blessed are the nonviolent. The third time and last time in Matthew's Gospel we encounter it is in the so-called triumphal entry, which we will be celebrating at the end of Lent. That's what we do on Palm Sunday. One of the few times that people actually get up and march around in church. So that's always a good thing. And again, someone who has a good, strong voice, let's just read through this so we can remind ourselves of the context that this comes up in. Somebody just want to read the text that's on the screen, please.
When they had come near Jerusalem and had reached Bethphage at the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, "Go into the village ahead of you, and immediately you will find a donkey tied and a colt with her. Untie them and bring them to me. If anyone says anything to you, just say this, 'The Lord needs them,' and he will send them immediately."
What a curious little vignette in the Gospels. It seems almost like a set of stage directions or something, and doesn't really seem to advance the plot much, because you get the instructions to go get these animals, and then they go get these animals, and then Jesus hops on the animals and rides into Jerusalem. You're thinking, why all the concern with going out and getting this stuff? And my sense is that the literary function of a story like this is to draw our attention to the fact that this march on Jerusalem is very highly choreographed. This is an intentional parade. Jesus has thought through what he's going to do, why he's going to do it, and hence it allows a little bit of an insight into Jesus as a practitioner of nonviolent direct action. Because nonviolence is something that is not meant to be reactive but proactive. It's supposed to be very intentional, very disciplined, and it often attempts to engage the public square with symbols of meaning. So when Martin Luther King and his civil rights marchers pray on a bridge in the teeth of dogs and fire hoses, that's not just a sort of heroic resistance, that's also street theater. You follow me? And so this, when the Berrigans go and put ashes on the pillars of the pen, that's street theater. And we have a rich tradition of nonviolent street theater. And this, I believe, is some of the roots of it. So here we've gotten the animals, and the whole point of getting the animals is to introduce a symbol that would have been intelligible to a first century Jewish Palestinian audience. And here, of course, Matthew is always explaining the Hebrew Bible allusions in case his audience might miss them, which is always good for us. Somebody want to read this text, please?
"This took place to fulfill what had been spoken through the prophet, saying, 'Tell the daughter of Zion, look, your king is coming to you, meek, nonviolent, and mounted on a donkey and on a colt, the foal of a donkey.' The disciples went and did as Jesus had directed them. They brought the colt, the donkey, and the colt, and put their cloaks on them, and he sat on it."
Now, what we have is a reference to the prophet Zechariah. But what is Zechariah saying? It's just a text that is being alluded to. It comes from Zechariah 9, and this is the full text, because I think it's important for our theme that we read the full text. Somebody want to read that?
"Shout aloud, daughter of Jerusalem. Lo, your king comes to you, triumphant and victorious is he, humble and riding upon a colt, the foal of a donkey. He will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem, and shall command peace to the nations."
So this animal just isn't any animal. This is a very poignant, prophetic prop that means to symbolize the prophetic vision of a Messiah who comes not to wage war, but to banish war. The fact that Jesus hops on a donkey is a very intentional allusion to what he's about. This is nonviolent street theater at its best. it would have been unmistakable to a first century audience what was going on here. And that is why this text is so deliberate in choreographing this moment. Now, those who would have known the narrative of Zechariah would have also known that when Jesus is professing from the Mount of Olives, the allusion is to a later part of Zechariah. And somebody, I realize it's a little bit smaller, so maybe somebody up here in the front pew could read that out loud.
See, a day is coming for the Lord, when the plunder taken from you will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses looted, and the women raped. Half the city shall go into exile, but the rest of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations, as when he fights on a day of battle. On that day, his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives.
So this later vision, this is part of the so-called Apocalypse of Zechariah, is sort of a vision of the final battle, when all the nations are gathered and are taking on Jerusalem, and essentially the city is under siege. This, ironically, was exactly what happened about a generation and a half after the death of Jesus. The Roman army surrounded Jerusalem, laid siege to it for a year and a half, and finally conquered the city, razed it, burned the temple. So this is part of the prophetic prescience, the ability to not gaze into a crystal ball, but to see the logic of history as it's unfolding. Well, when Zechariah talks about that final siege and the Lord touching down on the Mount of Olives with his feet, that's the call to battle, to the final battle. But the fact that Jesus starts this street theater at the Mount of Olives, which is pictured here, mounted on a donkey, is putting these two things together, saying, here comes the final battle, but it's not going to be a military battle. It's going to be the initiation of the great nonviolent struggle. That is what's going on in this street theater. And of course, we, as blissfully ignorant of the Hebrew Bible in our churches, we tend to miss most of this, and we miss some of the best parts. Well, let's get to the final bit of the Palm Sunday liturgy. Somebody want to read that?
A very large crowd spread their cloaks on the road, and the others cut branches from the trees and spread them on the road. The crowds that went ahead of them and the followers were shouting, Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest heaven.
So Jesus marches into the city accompanied by an army of peasants whose rapturous cries resemble a revolutionary chant. Hosanna, blessing to the Son of David. That's a messianic chant that is envisioning the restoration of the sovereignty of Israel. Images from the parade call to mind all sorts of biblical images, including the Zechariah one, but there's Judah who rides a colt triumphantly in Genesis 49. There's the story of the return of the Ark to Israel in 1 Samuel. There's the declaration of Jehu as an upstart king in 2 Kings. And there's a royal processional hymnal in Psalm 118. And again, the fact that the procession starts near the Mount of Olives brings to mind the Zechariah images. So all of this theater is sort of this layers and layers of allusion to, frankly, political aspirations of the people. At the same time, this street theater is alluding to things nearer at hand. Just a few years before the destruction of Jerusalem, and hence maybe a couple of decades before the writing of Matthew, there was a guerrilla general called Maccabeus, about 150 years before, who liberated Palestine from Hellenistic rule. According to 1 Maccabees 13:51, Simon Maccabeus entered Jerusalem with praise and palm branches, with hymns and songs. Sound familiar? Similarly, just a few decades before the writing of Matthew, midway through the Judean revolt, according to the Jewish historian Josephus, the guerrilla captain Menachem had marched through Jerusalem heavily armed and like a king. in an unsuccessful attempt to become the sole leader of the revolution. In other words, when Jesus marches on the city with a sort of royal choreography, even though he's twisting that in a Zechariah sort of way, it was unmistakable that this was political theater. So Matthew, who's following Mark's gospel here, uses all of these popular images in order to subvert them. Instead of riding a triumphant military horse, Jesus is riding a colt. This king enters Jerusalem completely unarmed, but just as dangerous to the status quo. This nonviolent siege will not follow the script that equates national liberation with the rehabilitation of a kingship. Rather, when Jesus comes to the temple in the very next episode in Matthew's gospel, it's not to defend the temple state, but to disrupt it. So all of that is going on. It gives a little bit more content to what Matthew understands meekness to entail. It is the practice of nonviolence as a public engagement with the powers. Does that make sense? Can you stop there for a second? That's what I believe Matthew's trying to get at. I think that is what Michael Crosby's trying to get at. And so it makes sense that when Jesus actually enters into Jerusalem, there's a big buzz, like, who the heck, what the heck is going on? This is not just a little churchly ritual. This is a big political moment. This is Dr. King at the Lincoln Memorial in 1963, throwing down the gauntlet to the nation, and everybody's buzzing about it. You're either for it or against it. I love this painting, by the way. This is my favorite image of the so-called triumphal entry. I have a poster of it hanging in my office. It's called Christ's Entry into Brussels in 1889, painted in 1888 by a Belgian author. In other words, he's imagining what the scene might be like if Jesus were to march on Santa Barbara. Who would show up? Who'd be happy? Who wouldn't? Yeah. Viva la sociedad. This is the late 19th century when idealistic socialism and social movements were really percolating, so it's a big red banner, and you have to use your imagination what's going on in the mind of this particular artist. But you see death masks, and you see rich people, and it's, imagine, just for a minute, if we would, let's just put our thinking caps on, if Jesus were to march on Santa Barbara, would that Santa Barbara were important enough for Jesus to march on? Who might show up accompanying him?
The homeless.
A couple of you would, good for you. I noticed not everybody was signing up right away. That's perhaps wise of you.
The homeless would, yeah. I think the teeth marchers would get behind him.
Well, one would hope.
I think the politicians would be there.
They'd be there, but they'd probably want the podium, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
It's sort of interesting. I don't know what would happen, but I know what happened a little over a week ago when Colin Powell came to town. Some of us were out there trying to offer an alternative voice and presence, but that place was packed out, and people were loving the stuff he was dishing out. I wonder what would happen if Jesus could just get on the docket of the UCSB lecture series. Sort of an interesting question. Well, that's sort of as much as I want to say about the notion of meekness. I think Michael's done a great job in recalibrating our consciousness of this around nonviolence. And the notion of that the nonviolent will inherit the earth is not so much seen as an entitlement, we'll talk about that more in a minute, as much as it is, you know, the nonviolent are struggling not just for their own delicate consciences. We are struggling really for history itself. We're struggling for the redemption of the whole enchilada. We are really wanting for all of the world to be transformed, and that is the world we wish to inherit. A new world is possible. And that is the promise and the challenge that Jesus gives in his opening remark of the Sermon on the Mount, known as the Beatitudes. Let me stop there and just see if anybody wants to raise anything about sort of this from an exegetical point of view, from a textual point of view.
Yes,
go ahead.
Please see it, and just make it really obvious to everybody, you know, one way or another, depending on where you stand in the land, like what
you
really demonstrated.
Yeah. In other words, you know, our socialization in the centuries of Palm Sunday that is about waving branches and singing songs in a very depoliticized context has persuaded us that this is some sort of holy liturgy, and we forget the political dimensions of it. And so I think just as it's useful to read the life and death of Martin Luther King through the lens of Jesus, because King was a deep disciple of Jesus, sometimes it's helpful to read the Jesus story through the lens of Martin Luther King, because that sort of refocuses Jesus' ministry as the very engaged public struggle that it really was.
I would just really say, I guess Michael's chapter, I think, pretty specifically, that the people who weren't necessarily going to get in line would see the danger of that he posed to them, the threat and danger that he posed to their way of life and their...
From the gospel's point of view, there is no question that the authorities understand the threat of Jesus. They have already early on in the gospel story, they've already identified him as a threat and been plotting against him, and that of course just escalates throughout the Jerusalem narrative. So that when Jesus is executed as a political dissident, if you're paying attention to the story of the life of Jesus, it couldn't possibly come as a surprise. But it does to us because we're not paying attention. Perfect example of that, and apologies in advance if I step on anybody's toes here, but a couple of years ago when Mel Gibson's Passion of Christ came out, you have this sort of extended, rather gruesome meditation on the arrest, trial, torture, and execution of Jesus. This big meditation on the death of Jesus with absolutely no context of the life of Jesus and why these events would have come to be. And that, unfortunately, is the theology of many folk in our church. Jesus got whacked, but we don't know why. Mm-hmm. And so we imagine that Jesus is just this really good guy, and it was just extraordinarily evil people who had to take him out. Or it was some divinely ordained thing that had to happen, and there's just no social or political context. That is not a faithful reading of the gospel story. Yes.
Well, Ted, I even think it's more, not that we don't know why, we say that God required it. God the Father required this violent act to free us from our sins, and we still have the story that this violent God, this is the only way it could happen.
That's right. And that's,
instead of this is how it unfolded.
That's right.
And because of a faithful and nonviolent Christ as an example, you know, the overcoming death occurred.
Yeah.
And we still say, you know, I've only heard like one or two priests and all my years talk about the crucifixion in a different light.
That's right. And friends, that is why we have study groups. Because there's some theological work to be done in our churches. And our churches are still largely captive to some pretty dysfunctional atonement theories that go back 1,000 years to Anselm. And, you know, one of the problems with Jesus had to die for our sins is, why didn't we just get it over with it in the Christmas story? You know, if Jesus had to come to die, why didn't just whack him as an infant and save everybody a lot of trouble? Why did Jesus actually have to live a life? It is part of the theological impoverishment of our churches that we are not taking the life of Jesus seriously. The more seriously we take his life, then the more poignant his death becomes. Which is not to say that we can't also reflect on that death as a sacrifice on behalf of our sin. It still makes sense, but it makes political sense as well as theological sense, rather than theological sense and no political sense whatsoever. So this is the reason why we have these study groups, is to really continue to look at this kind of stuff. And I'm thankful to Michael for helping put the notion of meekness as nonviolence front and center. Yes, Alan?
Well, another way of stating what you're talking about, but for me it's very important for us as a group here that we've been dealing with over the years, is this emphasis on the humanity of Jesus and the choices that he had as a human being on a spiritual path.
Yeah.
It within his own tradition. So it's the struggle that as a human being he would have had, just in your talking about the tradition of the Maccabees and that military conquering and coming back after exile, and you know, having to make a choice. He had to come down as a human being finally on one side with options coming from the tradition. He would have had, in the end, that's where that temptation would have been very difficult for him, because it sort of would have been blind, because there was no sure answer. So I mean, that humanity to me is important.
That's right. I want to begin to shift gears here, because Michael himself does in his chapter. And I want those of you who have the book at hand to turn to page 86. And again, somebody with a loud voice who has the book, just read the first paragraph on page 86, if you would, please.
The relation between Christ and the land is as envisioned by Matthew's Jesus, thus turns upside down the prevailing ideology of society. This way of thinking also seems to have penetrated Matthew's household. What had happened to Israel throughout its history was now occurring in Matthew's house churches. The land was becoming an end in itself. The pursuit of wealth was taking precedence over seeking God's reign. The ordering of the house, its economics, was being used to give more to those who already had. Consequently, the landless were being kept out. While some households were prosperous and quite well off, many more people were poor, homeless, and marginated.
Well, thank God that's changed. This is the point that that Crosby, I think, really turns the corner and says, you know, if we are going to really talk about nonviolence in a first world setting, we better start talking about economics. And he gives a very heavy emphasis economics in the rest of this chapter. And that's exactly what I want to do. It is the most terrifying subject for us to talk about, particularly those of us who live in a very upmarket city, who are enjoyers of great dimensions of privilege. But what Michael understands and what Matthew understood is that you can't talk about nonviolence without talking about social power. Who has it? Who doesn't? And if we're going to be practitioners of nonviolence, we better understand how power is structured in our society. So I want to move into part two of our time this morning, which is a little exercise on calculating social power. And you've got that in this long-winded handout called Personal and Group Power Analysis. And we're not going to do this at length, but I do want to dip into it because I want us to feel the weight and the sting of this issue, because we are notorious in our churches for reveling around the high concepts. But when it comes down to how it actually takes feet and hands, we're pretty good at backpedaling. And so I want to push what I think Michael is pushing, namely, what does it mean for first world Christians, in of all places, Santa Barbara, to be looking at questions of social power, and particularly social power as it's economically configured. And this would be a good time to go to the bathroom. Now, conversation about social power is notoriously abstract, and we sort of start talking about it, and then pretty soon it devolves into a free-for-all, and anybody can mean anything, and it's all very vague, and we benefit from keeping that conversation vague, because everybody in this room has a measure of social power that puts us on the privileged end of the scale from global standards. We who are privileged have a stake in keeping that fact somewhat obfuscated. And doing social power analysis is both a very personal and a very political exercise in consciousness building. And sooner or later on the walk of our discipleship, these are tools we need to use. And these are things we need to be wrestling with. And you know what? It's really hard work, friends, for us. It's not nearly as happy as joining hands and singing We Are the World. But because we live in a world where the economy is still stratified, and you got some folks that live in large and other folks living on the street, we have to talk about this stuff. Now, let me offer a definition. This worksheet is a piece that my wife and I have done that we use in workshops, including anti-racism workshops, where we try to get some definition around what we mean by power. And somebody want to just read what, this is also on your sheet, but it's also on the screen here. This is really for the benefit of the tape. Somebody want to read that out loud?
Do we have any more copies of that?
Oh, yeah. It's one or two here. Might be a few floating around. Otherwise, you have to share. Yeah, there's a couple more copies. If you don't have a copy, raise your hand. I think we can do a loaves and fishes thing. Otherwise, we'll have to go back to Kinko's.
You don't want to have
this. Again, this exercise is one for you to take home, and really, I would encourage you at some point to take it home, read through it, and then at some point, this group or a small group of you may want to do more work on this. It's certainly more than we can engage in right at this moment, but I do want to, as I said, I want to just dip in. Somebody want to go ahead and read this slide, please.
Social power can be defined generically according to a combination of basic capacities. The Greek denominator means both power and ability, such as mobility, the ability to be where one is at home and to move where one wishes. Access, the ability to procure what one needs for health and well-being. Self-determination, the ability to make the decisions that most influence one's life. Influence, the ability to be heard and respected.
I believe this, in trying to get a handle on a substantive but generic definition of power, I think this is a fairly usable one. It really gives substance to it, so it's not vague. If someone is unable to control basic things about their life, if someone is relentlessly disrespected or rendered invisible, if someone does not have access to the means of a livelihood, those are all measures of social power. And that is how the world gets stratified. There are some folk who have social power, and there are some folk who don't. And it's not a black and white situation, right? It's a whole spectrum of power as defined by these things. The paragraph that follows attempts to give examples to illustrate what we mean by this. In order to look at our own social power, it's also important to understand how we perceive these things. And this is where the rub comes in for us, because we all live in a dominant social context, but then we all live in subgroups within that context, and then we all live as individuals within the subgroup within the dominant social context. And usually when we think of social power, we think of it subjectively. We think about how much power I perceive I have. And of course, we all, at that point, love to play the victim. Right? Well, you know, I may be, you know, in a household that's pulling down six figures or more, or I may live in a neighborhood where the houses, the mean house price is $750,000. Well, that wouldn't be Santa Barbara. Over $1 million. But, you know, I feel like I don't get hurt in church much, so I feel pretty powerful. The more power we actually have, the more we like to posture as if we are not very powerful. And that's sort of a favorite American pastime. And this model allows us to both recognize that subjective perceptions are important, but objective conditions are also important. And the purpose of doing this exercise is to be able to see the sort of complicated terrain in which we do this work. If you turn to the second page, it also has this model. I think a couple examples will snap this into focus for us. The first example is the example of my wife, whose name is Elaine. And she comes from German-speaking Mennonites, who were in Canada, who emigrated from Russia in the 1920s. So on one hand, she's a citizen of Canada, and her position is somewhat dialectic because on one hand, being a Mennonite as a small religious subculture, she would be sort of marginal in terms of the Canadian mainstream. On the other hand, these Mennonites all can pass as white folk. And so they're very much part of the dominant culture and enjoy the privileges that come with that. So in that sense, it's important to sort of realize the complex fabric. Within her ethnic subculture, she's relatively powerful because she has a master's degree and has access and mobility to education and to teaching opportunities. But at the same time, as a woman, she feels very marginal because it's a very patriarchal, the church is still very patriarchal. So what I'm trying to get at here is when you're doing power analysis, it's not simple, it's complicated. And there are lots of contradictions, but it's important to be able to name all the aspects of it and not just look at the indexes in which I sort of feel myself marginalized, because we can all concoct something like that. But also to be very honest about the ways in which we enjoy all sorts of unrecognized privileges and how much social power that gives us. If we don't do this work, we will never learn to be allies of folks who are much more radically marginalized than we are. Because we will simply, our silence around those things will be another expression of our privilege. Are you following me? Mm-hmm. This is hard work, it's a challenging work, but it's very, very important work to do. Now what I want to do for, and we'll go for about, just about 10 minutes, and then we'll take our cookie break, okay? So we're going to get our cookie break. I just want to take about 10 minutes and just have you, what we've done in this chart here on page 5, which is the sort of payoff here, is we've given a number of different indices of ways of calculating power, broken into essentially two themes. One are the kinds of stuff that we might call the stuff of nature, right? I was born a woman, I was born with a tendency to go bald, you know, those kinds of things, including our psychological makeup. And then there's the stuff that is the result of nurture. Class, education, religion, social mobility, and so on. And what I want you to do is just with your pen, just for a moment, and you'll notice there are two columns. One is, how am I located according to the way these things tend to get structured in the dominant society, right? No matter how you feel, if you're white, or if you're perceived as white, you have enormous amounts of privilege in this society, right? So you got to be honest about that, and so you're going to be, you know, over here on level 4. Now, there may be circumstances in your own specific context which are different. but in the dominant context. And so what we've done is we've sort of filled out the dominant context, and I think most of this would be pretty unarguable. That when it comes to age, for example, most social power lies in folks between 30 and 65 because they're pretty much running institutions, whereas folks younger than that and older than that tend to have less social power in the way that dominant society works, right? And to take a controversial one that we don't like to name, when it comes to stature, physical strength, or physical appearance, let's admit it, folks who are healthy, attractive, strong, have more social power than those folks who don't. That's the reality in our dominant culture. And right on down the line, I think most of this stuff is relatively uncontroversial. So then what we invite folks to do is take a few minutes and just say, okay, in terms of my own subjective perception and where I stand in all of this, where would I locate myself? And what you would usually do is do it against a certain context. So you might do this exercise and say, relative to Santa Barbara, right, here's how I fall. And then you might do it again and say, relative to my parish, here's how I fall. And you see how it might be different. You know, and then in another exercise, you might say, relative to my Rotary Club, or relative to my extended family, or something like that, right? So what I invite you to do is just take 7 or 8 minutes and just sort of decide, okay, I'm going to do this relative to X. And then I'm going to just quickly go through this and say, this is where I think I am, in if I'm honest. Here's my calculation of my social power. And don't be surprised if there are going to be some contradictions in that, because social power is too complicated. Yes.
The irony is that when I was in high school and had virtually no power, I was Quaker. And with the Quakers, we go out and do silent prayer when they would load the napalm onto the ship from Port Chicago outside of Berkeley.
Yeah.
So, and we would be victimized. People would throw, you know, full beer cans at us and destroy our tires and our cars and stuff. And we were perceived to have no power whatsoever. Ironically, that was, when you look back, you say, well, that's a Gandhi move. That stopped the war. It was him and what he came. So in actuality, what looks powerless, stupid, is perceived as being irrelevant, troublemakers, long hair, and hippie freak, turns out to be the most powerful in your entire life and stops the war. But it's like, somebody likes to pretend like that didn't happen. It's not even mentioned that, you know, the Quakers helped, you know, stop the
war. That's right. But before we look at the transformative power of nonviolence, we have to do this work to see how power is actually distributed. Before we start talking about the way that you can flip the script and subvert the script. So let's just take 5 minutes and just sort of play with this a little bit, because I just want you to get a little taste of this kind of work. Let's just do that and I'll gone here in about 5 minutes so we can get onto the coffee and cookies. And friends, while you might not have time to get to everything, I want you to make sure that you do the first one under social cultural importance.